Welcome to the Fourth Age, a Wheel of Time podcast brought to you by DragonMount.com.
The Wheel of Time is an epic fantasy series created by Robert Jordan.
At its conclusion, the series will consist of 14 novels and one prequel novel.
Sadly, Robert Jordan did not live to see his work complete.
Brandon Sanderson, appointed by Mr. Jordan's widow, Harriet Rigney, will complete the series with the novels The Gathering Storm, Towers of Midnight, and A Memory of Light, based on the notes left by Mr. Jordan.
This podcast is dedicated to discussing and enjoying the monumental work of fiction that is The Wheel of Time. Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of The Fourth Age, a Wheel of Time podcast brought to you by DragonMount.com. I, of course, am Andrew Yellos, and with us this week is Virginia.
Hi, everybody. It's great to be here again, as usual. And with us also today, we have Spencer.
Hi, everyone. Great to be here.
This week, we're going to be re-recording and producing the first in our line of listener voicemail podcasts. The first time we recorded it, we had a little technical trouble, which I believe resulted in Virginia's ping being well over 2,000. Is that right, Virginia?
Oh, I think it was like 38,000 at one point, again. I don't know why periodically I have this problem where I live, but it's the downside of living in a rural environment. I'm only slightly more technologically advanced than Emmonsfield.
Yes, nonetheless, we really felt that we had to go back and definitely reintroduce all of the wonderful little listener voicemails that came in to us. So without further ado, we will go into that. Be aware, of course, that because we're going to be talking about pretty much every book in the series, from New Spring up through Gathering Storm, there are going to be spoilers. I mean, let's be honest with each other. We spoil things all the time, and we are not ashamed of it. So, you know, be aware that if you've not read through all the books, you might want to tune out until you have.
Yeah, we're not only going to spoil everything in the Wheel of Time, but we'll probably spoil stuff in every other fantasy and science fiction epic that you could think of, whether it's written or film or anything else. That's just the way we are. That's how we roll. We're bad.
Incidentally, we would also like to thank everyone who has volunteered their services to help in editing so that we can actually manage to get this podcast out to you more frequently. We are taking absolutely everyone who volunteers their services, and we've got a regular schedule actually starting up now with Spencer as our chief editor. But we would definitely want to thank everybody once again for the massive in-wave of responses to our latest call for editors. Hopefully this will result in us getting a more consistent and enjoyable podcast to you all.
Wait, what? I'm in charge?
What did yeah! You got promoted!
How do I make it stop?
No. It's a typical promotion. You get all more responsibility at no rise in pay. You can have 100% rise in pay since you get nothing. That works out pretty well for us.
Give me 300 and we'll talk.
That's a labor of love. Deal with it.
Also, one other thing, and Virginia mentioned this, we will also, in a number of instances, branch out and make connections to other fantasy series, other movies, television series, pretty much anything that has to do with science fiction or fantasy, we sometimes will digress into, as I'm certain our editors will attest to with much groaning and gnashing of teeth. We wanted to take this moment, because it does impact the Wheel of Time, to also mention that at the time of this recording, we have been keeping an eye on Suduvu. It's SUVUDU.com, which has been having its annual, I'm guessing it's annual, cage match versus fantasy characters. At this particular time, it is down to the finals, and we would like to announce officially, as it has been noted elsewhere, that the finals of the cage match for 2010 championship goes between Randall Thor and Jaime Lannister from George R. R. Martin's Song of Ice and Fire. There are a lot of different stats, and at the current moment, the host site, Suvudu, actually rates Jaime as winning in their perspectives. They have been mentioned by Brandon Sanderson. He decided to write up and wrote into them, and they actually also include a segment which says, click here to see why Brandon Sanderson thinks we got it completely wrong and why he's probably right and a much, much, much better writer than us.
Well, also, George R. R. Martin did write on his blog where he explained why Rand would win.
I just out of curiosity, because I have only just begun to follow this for some reason, but the idea of a cage match made me think of it because that's what happened in the movie. Did Wolverine ever get involved in this contest?
I'm pretty sure this was only from. This was mostly characters. In fact, only characters from actual fantasy novels rather than graphic novels or movies. Although they did take some of the novels that had been turned into movies, they did use pictures of the actors. Or actresses, as the case may be. Because we're pretty sure that this will come out after the final voting is closed, and we're pretty sure that Rand has won, we're going to say, yay, Rand. But if he doesn't, then we were wrong.
And he was totally robbed.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. We will lament. But right now it's actually only 2% difference between them, but Rand is ahead, and of course I cast my tiny little vote, so that certainly will make the difference.
Every vote
counts. Current votes are... Yeah, the current votes are totaling at around 16,790-ish, this before I and Virginia voted. And Rand was in the lead at 51% with 8,621 votes to Jaime Lannister's 8,169 votes. It should be noted that in the previous round, Jaime, I believe, was actually behind up until the last hour, in which case he got like a boost of a ridiculous number of votes. So it could go either way. We're going to go ahead and predict that Rand's going to take it anyway, just because even without one hand, he still has the advantage in channeling, and I'm sorry, no amount of madness can overwhelm the fact that Jaime has absolutely no magic and lost his sword fighting hand as opposed to Rand, whose sword hand is still good.
Not to mention the fact that Rand is the Dragon Reborn, and as a Taveren, he will twist fate around his person, and he will win.
Yeah,
also, our
fans
are way cooler. Or real-time fans are will. Also, Wheel of Time fans are way better than, are way more organized and better at get up and go than a Song of Ice and Fire fans.
That's right, and we've all figured out that you can vote numerous times if you can log on from different computers to do it. Cut that out. I'm sorry, that's the Hermione Granger in me coming out.
Coming back for revenge.
Yeah, because she got whipped in an earlier. She got whipped bad in an earlier one. What's up with that? Clearly.
Oh, yeah. Harry Potter fans. Every Harry Potter fan out there. Jaime Lannister apparently somehow beat Hermione Granger. You got to get back at him by supporting Rand.
What a rip.
Not only that, he took her out in the first round. How sad is that?
Unbelievable.
She never even got a chance to shine. And I never even got a chance to talk correctly.
I can just hear Ron in the background going, are you a witch or what?
So, and all now that our shameless plug for our favorite protagonist is done with, we will proceed on to our listener voicemails.
Unfortunately not, because I've got another shameless plug. Okay, one more shameless plug. On Audible.com, they are having their third annual tournament of audiobooks. They are also in the finals, and the final is between The Help by Catherine Stockett and The Gathering Storm by Robert Jordan and Brandon Sanderson. I can't say anything right tonight. Too bad. Audible has down that The Help will win in a nail-biter, 55-45. If I remember correctly from when I voted just recently, because unfortunately you can't see the results of the voting unless you actually have voted. So, Virginia, are you voting right now?
Darn it, no, I can't, because I'm on an iPhone and it uses Flash and iPhone.
There is an HTML version.
There is? Okay. There it is. Okay. Got it. Go in there now. Steve Jobs refuses to acknowledge Flash or the existence thereof, unfortunately. Or should I say, unfortunately, voting on the matchup now. Ooh, good news, everyone. Oh, no, I have to do that in a real Futurama style. Good news, everyone! No, I can never do the professor properly. Gathering Storm, 53.7% to The Help, 46.3%. Yay!
So, again, we don't know who's going to win. We can kind of assume that the Gathering Storm will come out on top, but and we hope and pray that it will, because, you know, getting number one on the New York Times just wasn't good enough.
We are the champions, my friend.
Yeah.
Because we're the best. It has to come out. It has to.
Yep, yep. Because getting number one on the New York Times just wasn't enough. We have to get these fan-based voting tournaments.
I never even heard of The Help by Catherine, and I never heard of Catherine Stockett. I guess I'm a barbarian when it comes to literature then. Huh.
I'm sure the readers of Stockett have never heard of The Gathering Storm either.
Well, there you go. Can you hang on for just a second or go on without me real quick? I've got to go do something really, really quickly.
Mention this. I love on Martin's blog. It says, you know, the good news: Jaime Lannister pulled out and defeated K'voth. Came from 700 votes behind in the final hours to win handily. All thanks you guys. Thanks to all who voted for him and to all of you who voted for his opponent, misguided though you are. And to Patrick Rothfuss, a fine author and a good sport, who made this round a lot of fun. And then, you know, he says, the bad news, Jaime is in the final, and his opponent is Randall Thor. Let me see, Rand is a master swordsman. He's got one of those Heron Mark swords, which is probably the equal of Valyrian steel. He's the reincarnation of the greatest hero and wizard of the history of Robert Jordan's universe. He's got Balefire, and then there's the whole Taverin thing he's got going. Jaime has gilded armor, a shield, a Valyrian steel sword, and a dwarf. Bugger. Martin's thing goes on and basically says, you know, he basically throws out a set of different, you know, things and whatnot. He is my counsel for this round, Tyrion said. Run away, don't look back. Jaime was not impressed. A Lannister doesn't run. This one does, Tyrion said. But I figured you'd say that, so here's what you're going, or what you need to do to have any hope of surviving this one. He then goes on to say, you know, Jaime's last match was fought on K'voth's home turf, an away game. Therefore, Jaime demands that this final round be played on his own home ground in the tourney grounds outside of King's Landing, according to the customs and traditions of Westeros. And should the Wizards of Sedivu grant that request, he further demands that it be made a trial of seven to honor the seven gods. His right to demand such a format is sanctified by ancient Westerosi custom, and my first dunk and egg story, The Hedge Knight. Under the rules of the trial of seven, each combatant is allowed to have six companions to fight beside him, seven against seven. Jaime's six will be all be characters from the worlds and stories of George R. R. Martin. Rand is free to fill out his six characters with the works of Robert Jordan and Brandon Sanderson. Yes, he can even include Conan, since Jordan wrote about him. Seven against seven for all the marbles, Jaime's challenge. I'm sitting here thinking, reading that, does Martin want Jaime to lose?
Well, doesn't he go on to say Jaime loses anyway?
Okay, I'm back. Sorry.
I mean, honestly, all Rand needs is himself, Nynaeve, and he wins. He doesn't even need all seven. Granted, he
might take Matt. I didn't actually
read that far. He might take Matt and Perrin along with him to kind of even things out a little bit, but still. Well, then Avienda would make sure that she was there, as would Min, and I guess Elaine would have to go too, otherwise she'd feel left out. So there's the seven, and he still wins.
Yeah, I'll go back and reread that at some other point in time. Anyway, our first listener voicemail comes from Mike, and it is concerning, if I am not mistaken, the Nine Rods of Dominion.
Oh, hey, my name is Mike. I'm a listener out of Little Rock, Arkansas. I was just wondering, I've been listening to your podcast for a while now. In book one, Out of the World, the Aldemon is talking to Luz Theron in the prologue, and he talks about him being the Tamerlan and all that stuff. But he also mentioned something about being the master or whatever of the Nine Rods of Dominion. I don't have my book with me at the moment, and I haven't really done any research on it. Well, I've thought about it, but I haven't really done any in-depth delving into it. Could the Nine Rods of Dominion and the Daughter of the Nine Moons have anything in common? I mean, as far as, you know, Robert Jordan always put something in his books, and they're always just not mentioned just to be mentioned. I mean, there's some significance to a lot of things he puts in there. It's only mentioned once in the first book, and you have the Nine Rods of Dominion and the Daughter of the Nine Moons. And I was just curious if maybe y'all have thought about that or have done any research on that. I like your show. I appreciate it. And y'all keep up the good work. Thanks. And Virginia, I love your laugh. Thanks.
I love your laugh too, Virginia.
Oh, thank you. I'm embarrassed to laugh now.
About the theory that Mike came up with here, you're right. Robert Jordan doesn't put things in here coincidentally. However, I'm pretty sure that there is no connection between these two. About the Nine Rods of Dominion, from a question and answer on the DragonCon 2005, we get this from Robert Jordan. And now I have to scroll back down to where the actual question is. All right, the question is, I have a question about the Nine Rods of Dominion. We have a couple of references to this, and Ishmael says that Luzferin summoned the Nine Rods of Dominion. And theories have been floating around, are the Oath Rods not the Nine Rods of Dominion? From Robert Jordan, they were not the Oath Rods. The questioner, well, are they positions of power? Were they people or were they actual rods? From Robert Jordan, they were actual people, and they were, but you might call them regional governors of Earth. Regional governors of the planet. So if I say summon them, then we've got a guy who's been given, in effect, ultimate power.
He was like the High King, then.
He was the first among servants. Who's there? In...
First among equals?
Something like that.
I actually never connected the Nine Rods with the Nine Moons, so I don't know why. I think possibly because just certain numbers are just so, you know, numerologically and mystically important. You know, 7, 3, 9, that they just pop up all through the Wheel of Time and all mythology, basically. So I never did make that connection. I don't know why, but I didn't. I find it odd to refer to people and positions as rods of dominion, but I suppose it's an antique usage and it makes as much sense as a lot of other things in the Wheel of Time, actually. So, but that was a really good point. That's a good catch. I never had really, thought that much about that. As a really cool scene in the beginning of The Eye of the World too, and for some reason, maybe because it happens so early on, I think it gets overlooked.
Yeah. Really quick, I want to thank Isabel of the Theoryland boards, which is where this was originally posted.
I never made a connection between the nines either, and I always assumed that there was a particular numerological sort of set up to the symbology of the various moons. At some point I had it planned out where, you know, there was obviously the symbol, the full moon, the half moon, the quarter, crescent right, crescent left. I actually may have done the bull crescent and the capstone crescent and new moon. And I figured that they came down and it broke down. I basically figured that the concept of the nine moons was based on the various shapes of the moon and the various positions or ways you could view it in the night sky.
That's kind of interesting. That reminds me, absolutely apropos of nothing, of the silvered phases of the moon around Vallaluca's wagon.
Which I think is remarked on when Tuan joins the circus, that he becomes, that Luca is honored by the fact that his wagon has the various phases of the moon about it.
I think it's interesting, too, that she was enamored of Matt's ring, which has nine crescent moons surrounding the carving of the fox startling the two ravens into flight. But they were specifically mentioned to be nine crescent moons.
Well, and elsewhere we've seen the nine crescent moons as well. One of the nations, I don't remember which it was, but isn't there one of the nations at least that has nine moons on its banner?
No, I think Tyr has a crescent moon on its banner.
Either that or it was the personal banner of Lanfear.
She had a crescent moon and a number of stars.
Just shoot me down all over the place, Virginia, okay?
I'm sorry, I'm not trying to.
Ilion had the nine bees, that's what you're thinking of, with the number nine.
Yeah, probably.
The golden bees!
Yeah, who doesn't want bees as your mascot? Anyway.
I'm sorry,
yeah,
Spencer. It's
nine.
That brown Aja coming out. I'm sorry, Spencer. It's that brown Aja mode coming out in me.
Yeah. But the number nine does seem to be significant a lot in the Wheel of Time world. Actually, a lot of the multiples of three do. 3, 9. There's 12s every once in a while. 13 more often than 12, though. But you think about it, you have the three major Taveran that the pattern is using to correct itself. We have
postulize that there are three powers, the true power, the true source, and whatever it is the creator has. Although that's more, that's simple postulation on our part. Robert Jordan did a good job of bringing in a lot of the symbology of our world and tying it in with theirs. The symbology and the mythology of our worlds and combining them.
He really does. All he's lacking is some metaphorical cats in boxes.
I think those are the sisters that have been in the library for years.
Yeah. No way to tell if they're dead or alive until you actually look. And then by looking, you've changed it.
Yep.
I confess I can't add anything else to the discussion of the Nine Rods of Dominion, or the Nine Moons, so maybe we should move on to the next voicemail. I don't know why I can't come up with it. It seems like that would be fraught with a number of good associations, but that's all I got.
So yeah, well, that's an interesting theory, Mike. I had to say that it's probably just the usage of the nine in the world and not that there's actually a connection between the nine rods and the daughter of the nine moons or the nine baby civilian or any of the rest of the nines. So our next voicemail comes from Trevor, and he's talking about Loghain.
Hi, this is Trevor Doolin, and I was calling in regard to Loghain. You know, everybody's always mentioning his future glory. He's going to reunite the tower. He's going to destroy the Tame and the Black Tower. But nobody ever makes mention of his bonded Aes Sedai, Gabrella and Tovain. Now, I think that it's very possible that part of the reason that he does reunite both male and female channelers is because Gabrella is pregnant. And the Crossroads of Twilight prologue, there's reference to playing the direct quote, she says, playing the Domani turned out to hide many surprises and a few pitfalls. Worst of all, a trap she could never reveal to anyone. Now, I think that that's a very veiled reference to a possible pregnancy that she hasn't been able to take care of, if that's something she'd even be willing to do. So, but I'd like to know what you guys think, and thanks for listening.
Well, that is very interesting, and it could be. I'm not saying that it couldn't. I'm just a question of semantics here. If it's something she can't reveal to anybody, a pregnancy is something that's kind of hard to hide. I don't know. Maybe I'm just trying to play devil's advocate here.
I never thought of a pregnancy. That's actually kind of an interesting idea. I so rarely get pregnant, apparently, or bear children at all. I had just assumed that the trap that she couldn't reveal was that she had actually fallen in love with him, but that's just my take on it. Andrew, go ahead. I'm sorry I interrupted you.
No, it's all right. I honestly glossed that particular that particular passage in the book. I had reread it at one point in time, but again, I think I very much associated it with her just having fallen in love with Loghain. I didn't, you know, even think that it might be a pregnancy. I didn't even think that it possibly could be a pregnancy, and I guess we're just actually probably going to have to read and find out on that one, because that is an interesting idea, and yeah, because Aes Sedai so rarely do get pregnant, I mean, how would you react? I mean, not only an Aes Sedai becoming pregnant, but an Aes Sedai becoming pregnant by a man who can channel. I mean, that stigma is still really, really powerful in Rand Land. So, yeah, that would definitely be an interesting a twist on the entire geopolitical surface of, you know, channelers and the various towers and the interactions post-Tarmon Gaiden.
Well, I think, especially post-Gathering Storm, with leadership in the White Tower, Egwene is very traditional in ways, and in other ways, she's branching outward. She's realizing that the world is changing, and she's willing to change a little bit. And I think this is one of the areas where she won't stick to tradition. She will understand that this needs to happen. We're culling channeling out of our race because of our reluctance to be with men that can channel, to even look at them for very long without wanting to gentle them. And so I think most of the problem that could arise from this will be coming from Tyene and the leadership of the Black Tower, because they are very strongly opposed to the White Tower and Aes Sedai
just because that's the way they tie him, because he's crazy and has not been treated well by the White Tower because he claimed to be the Dragon Reborn, but and those underneath him because they're as crazy as he is. But I think after whatever problems with leadership are resolved at the Black Tower, that any peace, truce, it might take a few years for an actual melding of the two towers, but I think a peace and an understanding will come up between the two towers that is much more lasting than anything that they currently have going on. I honestly can't see how one child will be that important to such a large group of people. Although I guess Rand is the Dragon Reborn, and he's one person. But still, I guess if it was Loghain's son and he obtains glory and whatever, then possibly. But I can't think that Gabriella would be that important.
Do we have anything else for Trevor on the issue of Loghain and Gabriella's possible pregnancy?
No, I don't know. I just was wondering about the Aes Sedai that were bonded by the Ashaman. Do you think Egwene's going to make an effort to gather them back in? And how is she going to deal with that now? I mean, she's in charge of everybody, and all the Aes Sedai are hers. What's she going to do about that group?
I really see a concentrated effort. Oh, sorry, Andrew.
No, go ahead, because mine will throw a monkey wrench into things, so go ahead.
Oh, God. Okay.
I really see a concentrated effort between Rand, now that he's at least somewhat mentally stable, at least I assume he is, and Egwene, with their powers having to go and take down Taim and his regime. And I see a lot of the, I guess, dreadlords for lack of a better word. I can see a lot of Taim's dreadlords being killed in that, and so their Aes Sedai being released. I can also see a lot of them escaping and taking their Aes Sedai with them, and some even escaping and leaving their Aes Sedai. But I think for the bond between the good Ashaman that we know are actually on Rand's side, those who are bonded to Aes Sedai, we've kind of seen the relationship they have. It seems to be a little bit more than a regular Aes Sedai warder relationship. I see those kind of groups as the foundation of a mutual tower of sorts. Grey Tower? That doesn't work. But I can see them as a start of an organization that includes both male and female channelers.
Maybe it won't be the Grey Tower. Maybe it'll be sort of like a black and white spotted, like a Holstein, like a gateway box tower.
Like
the
a Dalmatian?
Tower. Yeah, only more 50-50. Dalmatians are mostly white. That might fly in the face of the unstained tower, though. I just wonder.
You see them retrofitting Tar Valon, so you see the Ogier builders coming in and just color coordinating it so that one side is white, one side is black, and from the air it actually looks like the ancient Aes Sedai sign, and then they put up an actual black tower for the Ashaman.
Ooh, wow. Well, it's going to need some rebuilding, so it makes sense to bring the Ogier in there. And now they also have that. Well, it was, I think, the Warder's Practice Yard where Elida was building her ridiculous tower, her palace. So they got to get rid of that.
Let's just
take and do
that
something
down.
With it. Yeah, I mean, the Warders need their practice yard back.
Yeah. Anyway, let's let Andrew throw his monkey ranch now.
Oh, wait. One thought before I forget it. Wait. One thought before I forget it. Okay, now there's going to be Aes Sedai with Ashaman and Warders. There's going to be Ashaman with Aes Sedai. Are there going to be, like, more female Warders to sort of balance it out? We're going to have a place in the White Tower for the Aes Sedai, a place for the Ashaman, a place for the Warders, and we're going to have more like Brigitte. You know, they could be Warders to the Ashaman, but an Ashaman doesn't really need a warder, do they? Okay, I'm done.
No.
Well, the way I look at it, there are two different classes of Aes Sedai bonded to Ashaman. There are the ones like Gabriella who are bonded to Loghain and the people within Loghain's party. And then there are the Aes Sedai that we know of that were sent, who we imagine will get bonded to Taim's Ashaman. And in that particular instance, I have to wonder what being bonded to a dreadlord does to its Aes Sedai. If there is a component of conversion to where we're not just, you know, if Egwene goes and tries to, you know, bring them back or rescue them or reincorporate them into the tower, is she reincorporating the Black Aja right back into the tower again?
Oh, that would be such a bummer.
Well, you know, we haven't actually seen anyone be turned that we know of yet, and that device could not have been included just to be a hovering fear the entire show long.
The entire show? Oh my god.
That device was not included just to be a hovering fear for the entire series. It has to serve a purpose eventually, and it would be tragic if someone like Pavara got turned to the dark forcibly, which is why I could see it happening.
Yeah, well, that's been one of my favorite hobby horses, as you know, that we've got to see more of that. I really thought that Sherium would be a prime candidate for that, and possibly Loghain. But I think we're owed that. I think that's what Brandon referred to in one of our interviews with him as building up narrative debt to the audience. It's been mentioned and mentioned again, and if it's never used, that's, you know, sort of abrogating your promise to the readers. You know, it needs to be at least seen or resolved or explained why it was never done. They can't just not happen and go away. It figured too prominently in too many conversations.
You know, that could be what Brandon was talking about on the Torres, this thing that's been in the books, this thing that's been foreshadowed for books and books and books, but no one's really picked up on it.
I've never really figured out what the symbolism of the boat is, and the three women in the boat obviously are Nynaeve and Min and Elaine. Not Nynaeve, Elaine, Min, and Avienda. But I haven't really figured out exactly. I have to presume it's something that happens post-Tarmon Gaiden, but there's no way to know. I think that's going to be a Rafo read and find out.
Yeah.
I think we should do an episode on what we think is going to happen in Tarmon Gaiden. In other words, if you were writing the last battle for Robert Jordan, how would you wrap it up? We'll put that down on our list.
Yeah, maybe we should save that until shortly before Memory of Light comes out, though.
We could do it any time, and then we'll probably have to revise it after Towers of Midnight. After Memory of Light, our little world might be just over.
No, I think we'll still have enough to talk about.
Yeah, but all the problems will be resolved. Well, I don't know. They're still talking about Lord of the Rings, and that's been, what, 30 years?
I'm going to save.
Okay.
All right, well, we're going to move on to our next voicemail. This one is from Dale, and he's talking about Angriel. And I'm sorry that we're not giving you more information before the actual voicemail is played, but we're giving you all the information we have, so...
Hey guys, first I want to say love the podcast. This is Dale, and I'm in Dallas, Texas. The reason I'm calling, the way the Forsaken are always talking about how they wish they could find some Angriel or Stangriel or Terangriel or whatever, kind of confuses me, or I guess seems unlikely to me that none of them can have the ability to make their own. I mean, they come from this age where it was so advanced compared to the one that, compared to the third age, and for not one of the 13 most powerful channelers ever to be able to make any of these Angriels just seems a little far-fetched to me. And the only reason I can think of for maybe why they don't is that perhaps an Angriel that you make yourself won't work for you. So I don't know if that has any weight or faith. You guys being the experts have anything that could back that up or refute that?
I've thought about this, and last time I definitely remember this branching into a very interesting discussion on why none of the Forsaken seem to create Angriel or Terangriel or any of the various objects of the One Power. But as I was listening to it this time, the thought had just occurred to me that we know for a fact that an Angriel created by someone can be used by that person, because Elaine tested a number of her own Terangriel when she tried to copy the various dream rings and other sorts of objects of the power that she had tried. So we have to assume that the creator of an Angriel or a Terangriel can then also use them. As to why none of the Forsaken have created objects of the power, I really think that boils down to the creation of Terangriel, though more common in the Age of Legends, probably was still a certain kind of talent that you either possessed, you know, an ability or an affinity for doing that sort of work with the One Power, or you didn't. And when you really look at the Forsaken, they're really specialized in what they did with the power or the ways they used it. I'm just guessing their strengths tended to lie in other areas or other specialties.
Well, and even if they didn't, if you have the talent to make an Angreal or Terangreal, you have to practice. You have to actually use it. You have to know how to use it. You have to have the common knowledge. And we know that the Forsaken were so self-centered that if there was something that they didn't feel was worth their time to learn, they didn't learn it. Asmodian didn't even know how to travel because he never wanted to take the time to do it. So I think it's very likely that none of the Forsaken just took the time to find out whether or not they had the talent and to cultivate that talent if they did have it.
When I sort of got a sort of an aside, I think it was from, pretty sure it was from Mogedion, she was musing to herself about this, that, and the next thing, and she thought to herself that it was interesting what they were doing. I think it was with the Quendiar, perhaps, but she didn't understand it herself. She was no maker herself. And so I kind of got the sort of impression that maybe they looked on them sort of like, oh, they're just craftsmen, you know, even though they're making Angreal and Terangreal that they all use and want. But it may have been a little bit of a, you know, looking down on it sort of thing, because it was maybe more commonplace than we might have imagined. I'm assuming that Angreal and Terangreal and so forth were fairly common during the Age of Legends. I mean, they had things called standing flows and communicators and all sorts of goodies. So, you know, elevators, the lifts, they call them, and, you know, all these things. So I'm presuming that they were available right, left, and center. So there were obviously a lot of people available to make them, and they were just considered to be, you know, a crafts class of makers. I don't know. I'm sort of wandering here, sorry.
Blue-collar channelers.
Yeah, that's where I was going.
Well, I had to wonder, though. We know that Terangreal can be made by one person, but we also know that the greatest feats of the power are done by at least one female and one male channeler. But taking that back a few steps, you would think that in a link you would be able to create greater. So I have to wonder if to create an Angreal, which in my mind is better than standard Terangreal, to create an Angreal if you have to work with others. And we all know that that's not something the Forsaken do well.
I don't know.
Well, there
I
is
just
a thought.
Yeah. I don't know. Well, I think that there's probably something of that involved in making the major Terangreal or Angreal, like, you know, or Sangreal, like Kalendor or something like that. But I have a feeling that for the, you know, everyday run-of-the-mill things, it probably was about as much talent involved as assembling a cell phone or something today. And they probably, you know, had, maybe they had like assembly lines of low-grade channelers who could just make stuff.
Well, you know, my thought processes are catching up now, but originally I was just thinking, you know, the Chodan Call, those had to have been made by a circle, including both male and female channelers. They're just too powerful to have not. But going down from there, the Angreal that we've seen used, specifically by Moraine, the lady statuette and the bracelet of a person folded back on themselves, those just seem really personal and kind of like craft items. So, and you think of works of art, and they are very personal, singular, one person. So I retract my earlier theory in favor of logic.
I could see that. I could see Angreal maybe being a personalized thing. It might be that in order to do Saw Angreal, you would have to have a combination or a link between channelers. Because it seems like, you know, well, if I can make an Angreal, I should be able to make a more powerful Angreal, too, and make a Saw Angreal. And it's like, that doesn't seem to add up. It seems like in order to create something that's going to give you expansively more results, you're going to have to put in that much more effort or that much more work. And that seems, at least in my mind, to require at least a link between, you know, two individuals.
Yeah, I think it's just a level. I think it's a matter of degree. I mean, a bicycle and a space shuttle will both get you places, but there's a lot more involved in making a space shuttle than there is a Schwinn. So I suspect that there were probably different levels of ability required to make different levels of complexity Angreal or Turon Grill or Sauron Grill, and I, with this, as far as the ones that were made out of sort of objet d'art, they probably had artisans crafting these things and then channelers actually taking them the way Elaine did with the rings and everything, you know, and making them into doing the process to them that Elaine was doing with the ring, which started out as stone but became something more. But I think it was aligning the matrices was the weave that she used. And she was able then to transform that into something else. So there probably were several stages of fabrication involved in some of these things. And, you know, maybe some of the lesser channelers were sitting there, you know, getting sick and tired of just producing these, you know, call box Turangriel and hoping they could level up and maybe make something really cool like Kalendor someday, but maybe no hope of doing it. I don't know.
Well, we know, though, that channelers were also artists. Asmodian was a channeler, but still his major calling was as a musical artist. So I think that the Angriel that have survived from the Age of Legends were crafted by artists who then also powered them. I guess I'm nitpicking a bit too much. Branching off of this a little bit, though, Elaine doesn't seem to, you know, she's considered somewhat of a wild card among the Aes Sedai. She's experimenting with the power, and she could burn herself out, and don't ever do like she's doing. But if you think about it, really, she's not being that experimental. She's recreating things that she's already seen have been created and work. She's not trying to create things. She's trying to copy things and or take things and change them a little bit, like she did the Aedom. But I would love to see her actually create something. I don't think we will, because as she's getting progressively closer and closer to giving birth, she's losing her ability to actually channel. So unless she gives birth like in the middle of Towers of Midnight, and we actually have time to see her try and create stuff between Towers of Midnight and the Time and Gaiden.
I think there was one Turangriel that she made that was all hers. Wasn't it something to do with invisibility, or like the one that Moraine made that used at Master or something, or like a weave? I don't know. Maybe I'm reaching for that one. But
well, she carried a deerhorn, what do you call it, dagger from the
Chat,
and that was supposed to make you invisible. But I don't remember necessarily. I don't know.
She did put a seeking on someone similar to what Moraine put on the coins that she gave to Rand, Matt, and Perrin, and she kind of explained the seeking a little bit more, which was nice after it had been so many books, and we had never really gotten an explanation of what Moraine had done to be able to track the three boys. But
yeah, I think it was a finder.
I'm not sure if that's yeah, that's right, it was a finder.
Yeah, she put it on that fellow that they sent after David Hanlon, just to track him down, and she did mention that it worked a lot better, that it would last basically forever on, like, the metal belt buckle, but it would only stick with fabric, you know, the clothes and so forth for a certain period of time, but she wasn't going to tell him that. As far as the deerhorn thing, I think the deerhorn thing didn't make you invisible, it just rendered you kind of persistently unnoticeable by the Dark One. I don't think it in actual invisibility.
And Shadow Spawn.
There was some Turangriel that she made, though, that she hated taking credit for the rings, the stone, you know, the dream rings, because they weren't really hers. They were just copies. But then she thought that one was all hers, or maybe that was a weave. I don't know. Now I'm losing my train of thought. I'm sorry. I totally got us off topic. I suppose we should move on to the next voicemail. Where is everybody?
I was going to get there. So our next listener voicemail comes from Sean, and it is concerning Balefire and the sickness.
Hello, everyone. My name is Sean. I'm a big fan of the Wheel of Time, and I first want to say that I really enjoy listening to your podcast. You always make interesting points and are enjoyable to listen to. I have a couple things I want to talk about. First of all, in regards to the last podcast, Virginia mentioned a theory about Rand being brought back to life by Balefire and was subsequently shot down for that. It seems to me that there was a bit of a confusion about how Balefire works, at least by my understanding. Balefire removes the thread of the person Balefired from the pattern, consequently undoing their recent actions. How far back that effect goes depends on the power of the person using the Balefire. So if Rand were to be killed after defeating the Dark One, then the individual who killed him, either some one of the Forsaken or some avatar of the Dark One or just some random Dark Friend, was then killed by Balefire. That would undo the actions of that individual. In this case, bring Rand back to life. Rand's sealing of the Dark One wouldn't be affected in any way unless the individual who killed him was some part of that sealing, or Rand himself was Balefired. So I just wanted to kind of give my opinion and hopefully clear that up and show that maybe Virginia's crazy theory isn't so crazy. Second thing I wanted to talk to you about was ask what your opinions are on Rand's sickness when he embraces Sidene. Is it perhaps caused by the link with Moradin? The fact that Moradin channels the true power? Maybe, or maybe it's something like the way that Brigitte and Elaine affect each other? Do you think that he is going to be healed in some way before the last battle? Or maybe only by Moradin's death, if that's the cause? Just in general, I'd really like to hear your opinions on the ramifications of Rand's sickness towards the last battle and his fight with the Dark One. So thanks for listening to my message, and hope you enjoy discussing what I've brought to the table.
All right. There's a lot in this particular voicemail on the point about Rand being brought back by use of Balefire. This is a multi-podcast disagreement that has gotten a little confused a couple of different times. And honestly, I'm going to say it right now. We'll talk about it, and then we will agree to disagree, mainly because it's a debate over how the mechanics of Balefire works. The original argument, which Virginia was shot down for, was if Rand were Balefired and then the person who Balefired Rand was Balefired, whether or not Rand's thread would be reintroduced to the pattern, or whether it would, because it was Balefired, stay burned out of the pattern. And we have no answer for this. I am in the camp that a thread once burned out of the pattern cannot be rewoven because it's been burned out of the pattern. And that's why Balefire becomes dangerous, because if you get, you know, a person Balefiring a person who Balefires a person who Balefires a person, that's six threads that have been burned out of the pattern. And no, I did not actually count to see if I was correct in the number of Balefires versus the number of people I randomly chose to be burned out of the pattern.
I love it. And as we know, I come down on the other side of it. I think that when they're burned out of the pattern, even if somebody's thread is burned out of the pattern by Balefire, if that person was then Balefire, they would undo what they did, and so it would be put back. And all I can say is that I'm going to lump this Balefire effect in with time travel and quote my favorite Captain Janeway, "Time travel gives me a headache." Well, Balefire gives me a headache, too. I don't know how to resolve this debate. I'm just going to have to say I kind of disagree, but, boy, I can't come up with enough evidence to really espouse it that strongly. So I don't know. We're just going to have to find out.
Yeah, I mean,
but I'm Switzerland.
Like, yeah, I like I said, it's one of those things that's a real theoretical decision or discussion, and unless it's actually written somewhere, and you know, in a way that proves one side or the other, you know, we're never going to have an answer to this one. But as for the sickness, I've always originally assumed that a lot of the sickness came from not just the taint from the Dark One, but also from the dagger from Shadar Logoth that Padden Fain cut Rand with. Rand's been introduced to so much taint that, you know, I kind of have to imagine that that's part of the sickness, probably compounding the fact that, you know, the taint gives, you know, men, you know, the rotting sickness, which we just thankfully have never seen in Rand that we know of. Having the sickness also be associated with Moradin brings in the idea that it is a facet of Moradin channeling the true power instead of the one power. And we do know that the true power is addictive, and it is supposed to be much more dangerous than the One Power, but they never are very clear on where that danger lies. So I honestly think it might be a compounding issue that we've got two to three different types of taint all kind of, you know, flowing into Rand, and it's getting progressively worse. So I think it very well may be possible that Moradin's link to Rand could be, if not causing, at least exacerbating the condition.
This voicemail came in before the Gathering Storm came out, and there are a couple of things that happened in the Gathering Storm that I personally don't fully understand, and I'm not sure if anyone besides Brandon and Team Jordan do. An influence on this question and Rand's sickness, at least I think they do. One of them is the fact that Rand channeled the true power. And we're not sure if that's because he was baited and granted access, or if he somehow took X, grabbed it through Moradin, and so we just don't know. And the second one is what I lovingly refer to as Rand's conversion on Dragonmount, which to me read like Rand getting rid of all the crap that is infesting his body, that is just, like you say, all the taint that is inside and is corrupting him. The final chapter of The Gathering Storm to me reads like Rand burning all that stuff out. But it's the final chapter of The Gathering Storm, and we don't know actually what all the ramifications of it are besides the clouds start rolling back. But I think any discussion of Rand's sickness needs to include these moments, even if we don't know exactly what they mean yet.
Yeah, I've been on several minds on the sickness. I've gone from thinking it had to do with, you know, the taint, or channeling too much balefire, or being in contact with Moradin when he channeled the true power, and he channeled balefire and they crossed the streams, to, you know, all sorts of things. And I kind of am agreeing with Andrew that I think it's a combination, a compound effect. But one of the things that always sticks in my mind lately is that he's had those two wounds in his side forever, and the only thing that's really changed about them is that recently, after he got the second one, Dahmer Flynn basically, in his words, walled them off and sealed them up together, and maybe they'll fight each other and kill each other off before they kill him. He doesn't ever imply or think that his healing was going to remove either one of those two never-healing wounds from Rand. So maybe, because they're sitting there walled up, there's enough seepage between the two of them into Rand, still, even though they're walled off, to cause this unknown sickness. The only thing that really stands against that is that although none of the Ashaman really seemed to get dizzy and ill the way Rand did, they were all having some problems after the cleansing and the use of the Bowl of the Winds with Sidon doing weird things and snapping into place and the weaves not forming properly and so forth, but they didn't have the sickness that he had. So whether they're related or not, I don't know. But I'm kind of going to have to come back to the fact that I agree with Andrew. I think it's a compounding error. There are so many things that have affected Rand over the last 3 years that they're just all ganging up on him. But I could be wrong, too. Probably am.
Yeah, and I think it's just something, back both parts of this, I think it's just something that we're going to have to read and find out. Mr. Jordan, see what you've done to us all.
I'm sure he's laughing from wherever he is right now, rubbing his hands in glee. He's just got us going, and he's had us going for 20 years now.
Someone find the Horn of Valyr, and we'll bring RJ back to answer these questions.
Yeah, I'm all for that. It's like Brandon said with the pronunciations, you know, unless RJ comes down in a beam of white light, a lot of it's going to be unknown.
Yeah.
We are still going to try to get Maria on the show to help us with some of the pronunciations and a number of other interesting things, and hopefully that'll be forthcoming.
I almost want to see if we can get Maria and Alan separately so that we can have more time with each of them.
It's actually not a bad idea. It might be easier to accomplish, too. Or maybe they'll do three interviews, one each and then one together.
Yes!
Greedy, greedy!
We need to be greedy in that. We might as well get Harriet in here, too.
Yeah, that's what it's just to say. we need to figure out a way for the release of the next book to have one of us, or all of us, maybe probably wouldn't be possible, but to have an interview with Harriet.
I think the easiest thing, like, much as I would love to travel back, probably the easiest place to get to her would be at JordanCon or DragonCon, but unless we all manage to come up with some cash and travel back there, I don't see that happening. But
next year,
it might be possible that she would do a telephone interview with us. Maybe if we ask really, 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 really nice, and maybe get Jason to beg for us,
and send chocolate.
Maybe Jennifer, and send chocolate or whatever she wants. More Wheel of Time lolcats.
So our fifth. Am I right about that? 1, 2, 3, 4. Yes, sweet.
Yeah.
So our fifth voicemail of this particular episode is by an anonymous caller, and it deals with Rand and the Shangen.
Yes, I just had a thought about Rand and the Shangen when he, after he's had his revelation on Dragon Mount, will he possibly go back to Ibudar, possibly to Tuan, and then bow to the Empress because of the fact that the Shangen are dealing with the population so well, and he saw this in Ibudar, that he's losing the battle with all the people and trying to care for everyone and provide food, they're doing such a good job that with a new change of heart, he may finally fill the prophecies and bow down to the Empress. Just a thought. Thank you.
All right, I want to preface this. For all of you who have called in and saying, hey, I called in before the Gathering Storm came out, and where's my voicemail? We will get to it in later episodes, as we're re-recording this episode now, and these came in since we've recorded the last voicemail episode. We're going to throw them in now, because we're re-recording voicemails. So that's why we haven't gotten to yours yet. We will.
As for this one, we actually did have a discussion on this, mainly, I think, during one of the times when we were talking about Rand's seeming revelation or his epiphany upon Dragonmount. And I think that Rand probably will go back to the Shangen, and, you know, it may end up being that he does, you know, come with a more humble attitude than he did when... I'll be right back to finish my thought.
Yeah, I think I understand where you were going with that, Andrew. It just really seems, with the few lines that we got from Rand's point of view after his revelation, epiphany, I love to call it the conversion, I don't know why, but after his experience on Dragonmount, the little bit that we get from him while he's up there, he just seems so changed to me. And so I could very well see him going humbly before the Empress of Shangchen to negotiate some form of peace treaty for the purpose of saving the world from the Dark One.
I didn't actually hear that particular bit. What I was going to say was, yeah, I think Rand will go back and will be more humble, which eventually may lead to, you know, prostrating himself before the Crystal Throne, or before the Empress. Not because of what he saw in Ibudar, but because his answers from the fans seem to imply that he needs to make peace. You know, the north and the south must be as one, the east and the west. You know, everything must be as one. And I think he's going to realize that his tactics of trying to bully them into it was faulty, and that he needs to express more humility, and that will lead to him fulfilling that prophecy, which we don't know if it was altered or not. We do know that at least some part of the Shangchen prophecies was altered by Ishamael during his escape from the Boar, during one of those little sojourns that he had. So we don't know which portions of the Shangchen prophecies have been altered or not. There always seemed to have been a conflict that Rand would bind the Daughter of the Nine Moons to him via Randland prophecies, and that he would bow before the Crystal Throne via the Shangchen prophecies. And, you know, it might be that both of them are correct, and that translations being what they are, one's gotten lost along the way somewhere.
Well, and also we know from an interview that Virginia did with Brandon while he was on tour for The Gathering Storm that hopefully we can get out to our listeners now that we have a lot more editing help. We know that the Demoni of Shanchen have continued their foretellings and have added to the prophecies of the dragon. So the complete prophecies of the dragon as they are in Shanchen are not the same as the complete prophecies of the dragon as they are in Randland, because in the year since Luthair Pendrag left Randland for Shanchen, there's been more prophecies on both sides of the ocean, and they haven't been keeping track of each other's. So it could very easily be that that is an actual prophecy from a Demoni and wasn't altered by Ishamael, as I believe we were led to believe by Robert Jordan. I think it was written so that we would believe that, but that's why I think it might actually be a true prophecy. There is a way that they could both be true now that Rand is a more humble person.
Oh yeah, that pretty much wraps it up. Wow, I don't know. I think the prophecies are pretty different on both sides. There's some things in common and some not. I don't know how they're going to reconcile them. I guess that's something that the denizens of Randland and Shanchen will have to read and find out, or experience and find out, I guess.
So our last voicemail comes from Eric, and it's a response to episode 65.
Hello. This is Eric from Austin, Texas. I enjoyed episode 65. I thought it was pretty entertaining. I just want to go and say I like the podcast, and I'm always glad to see when there's a new one downloaded to my computer. So keep up the great work. I also wanted to mention nobody mentioned Aerith in that episode, which I thought was kind of odd. I think one of the guys especially would say, well, why not? So anyway, thanks. Bye.
For those of you not keeping track, episode 65 is our infamous Taverian date rape episode.
Oh, where to even begin? First off, Eric, thank you. Like I said, I have mentioned in a number of our forums and on our comments section that it was never actually meant to be aired as a podcast. Occasionally, during our earlier years, we would get together, and if we didn't actually have a topic of conversation for the podcast, we would kind of sit around and shoot ideas. And if an idea showed up early enough, we would then, of course, record a podcast. But every now and then, we would just have an evening where it was us getting together online and tossing out ideas or random comments, or even just determining when we would get together and decide the next five or six topic ideas for the podcast. And it became really, really, really obvious very early in this particular evening that we weren't coming up with an idea for that night. And it was just random things that were going back and forth. And the decision to actually air it as the lost episode was not an easy one. There were back and forth debates over whether or not we should air it or whether it was in good taste or not. To anyone who may have found offense in episode 65, it was never our intent to offend anyone. But to those of you who enjoyed it, we are glad, of course, that you enjoyed it. You know, it's always been said you're never going to please 100% of the people 100% of the time. And that's just the way this one particularly happened. As for Yadith, or not Yadith, gosh, I can't even talk tonight. As for Aerith, wow, that adds a whole new dimension to that particular rambling conversation. We've now gone from bridging the age gap to bridging the species gap, and just, I don't even know how to respond to that.
And now you all see why we edit these podcasts. And why we're kind of hesitant about putting together, this is a podcast of all the things that we've taken out.
Well, actually, the infamous episode that Andrew was referencing, it actually came to light again because in my infinite stupidity, I actually sent it to one of our editors by mistake, thinking it was a different file. And he dutifully edited it, and when I listened to it, I went, oh my God, that's not the one I meant to send you. I'm so sorry. And he said, oh no, this is hysterical. You have to play it. You have to play it. It's too good to keep in the dark. And I went, And it sat for almost another year before we decided, and then just because we couldn't get anything else edited, all of our editors but Spencer just had to move on to other things. I wanted to post something, so there it is.
Well, and over top of that, too, we were also, it would come up in other podcasts, recordings, something would lead back to either the Pillow Friends or various other discussions that were going on that particular evening, and they would come up with podcasters who weren't there, and so these podcasters were also clamoring, well, when are we going to get to hear this, because, you know, it just seemed like such an odd and off night that, you know, this conversation, you know, as the editor said, it just couldn't stay in the dark. So that's what actually led to, you know, lent a little more weight to there being an interest enough to warrant actually posting the episode. Truthfully, the concept of Rand's Taverin-ness being akin to date rape is totally not founded at all. And there is, of course, nothing at all funny about date rape or any sort of rape. We wouldn't dream of making light of anyone who went through any such a traumatic experience as that. And it probably should have been likened to... Oh, I don't even know how to explain that. God, yeah, I have no idea where to go from there.
Well, the title of the podcast was kind of misleading, because when I listened to it, I if you've heard it, I was not there while it was recorded, and like Andrew said, I've been hearing about this infamous podcast, and I've been just kind of, oh my, what? But when I actually listened to it, the title was misleading, because it wasn't, there was very little actually about the Taverin date rape. That was just the most sensational portion of the podcast. That's the podcast that's like, what? But the rest of it was all about who you would sleep with. And I think the majority of the podcast was taken up with that, rather than with the what the podcast is named for.
It was basically who was kind of sleeping with who as far as Pillow Friends, and eventually when we talked about it, we figured if Robert Jordan could write about Pillow Friends, then we could speculate on who were Pillow Friends, and then it sort of branched off into not so much who would you sleep with if you were in the Wheel of Time, but who would you date? And, you know, I mean, you could take it beyond that if you wanted to, but really it was, for the most part, fairly innocent fun, and if we offended anybody, we're really sorry. It just, like Spencer said, that one offhand remark about the Taverin date rape, which really only was an offhand remark, just somehow became the title of it. That's how we kept referring to it, because it was so weird.
Yeah, I mean, it was. Like Spencer said, it was the most, the glaring and the most, you know, shocking statement, and therefore, you know, it became the title of it. You know, it's like, oh, well, that was the burning boat evening, you know, and, you know, it could refer to almost anything, and it might have been the most minor portion of, you know, the evening, but that was the title because that's the most vivid comment. There was also, I also remember in that particular episode, I hemmed and hawed quite a bit over not making a statement as to who I would date, and, that all was basically prior to, this was during the last few months of my engagement to my now wife, and I was trying to be diplomatic and somewhat noble about not, you know, oh, well, I would date this person, I would date this person, I would date this person, and you know, it, and then, of course, I ultimately came down and admitted after we had stopped recording, which I am fairly certain was still kept in, that I would probably, of the Forsaken, choose either Grandel or Lanfear to date. And Lanfear because I, for some reason, just found it an interesting character, and Grandel because in many ways her description resembles my wife, and therefore, you know, I was safe that way.
Yeah, I've seen pictures of your wife, and she does rather have a Grendel appearance about her. I could see that. I'm fascinated by the fact that you seem drawn to these dangerous women. What's that all about?
It was probably because as I was trying to be pragmatic and you know, trying to stay out of the debate over who I would choose to be with at the Wheel of Time, I probably just overlooked a vast majority of the characters that I would find interesting. One of those things that I think I was intentionally trying to avoid the conversation so much that when I did finally get involved, I didn't actually stop to consider what I would actually do in that particular scenario.
Well, not only that, it would have been a little hard to top Andrew Miller, who was our former producer and host on the podcast, because I mean, he was just plain crazy. He's just wild. And he went the gamut from Bode Coffin to Cat Swain in one breath. I'm going like, wow, talk about eclectic tastes. Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. Well, we should probably start wrapping it up.
So, having gone through the original voicemails that we recorded in the first of our listener voicemail episodes and adding in a few new ones, I do believe that we have come to the end of this, our first episode of listener voicemail episodes. Once again, we'd like to thank everyone who calls in and leaves us a message, in particular for this particular episode, Mike, Trevor, Dale, Sean, Anonymous, and Eric. We always, always love getting any sort of communication from the listening audience, be it voicemails, emails, comments in the comments section, comments on our forum page on Dragon Mount, comments to our Facebook group, or various other places. And there are various number of ways, most of which I've just mentioned, that you can get a hold of us should you wish to contact the Fourth Age and share your criticisms, your feedbacks, your comments, your crazy theories, your not-so-crazy theories, anything you want to do to help enliven the discussion here in the Dragon Mount community, and the Wheel of Time community, for that matter. We will welcome and try to incorporate into the podcasts as they come along. The first and foremost method you can use to get a hold of us is, of course, contacting us and leaving us a voicemail at 1-888-33-7690.
And you can also reach us by emailing us at podcast@dragonmount.com. And if you don't happen to have access to the 800 number, say if you are not in the United States, you can always, if you have access to audio recording equipment of even the most basic kind, you can record an MP3 and email it to us, and that will work.
Also, on the podcast website, which is www.dragonmount.com/podcast, after each of the episodes, there is a comment section. And there are always several of us that are going through the comments and will reply back to you. Also on DragonMount.com, on the forums.dragonmount.com, there is a forum dedicated to the Fourth Age. And we are also active on that.
And you can also follow us on Twitter. Our username is Fourth Age with no space. And there's, as Andrew mentioned, a Facebook page, the Fourth Age. And if you want to become a friend at Fourth Age, just send a request and mention that you're with the podcast, and we'll just add you. There is a MySpace page too, but I don't think anybody's really keeping that up right now. So that may be, if not defunct, it may be going that way. I think we're pretty much just moving over to Facebook. It's the way right now.
MySpace is
I suppose I could make us a Ning group or something, but I haven't got around to it yet.
In addition, our host site, DragonMount.com, can also be found on Facebook, which is obviously found through Dragon Mount, and can also be followed on Twitter.
And if anybody's interested, a lot of you probably already know this, but Brandon Sanderson is also very active on Facebook. He has his own page, Brandon Sanderson, and he is very good about accepting friend requests and also updating his Facebook page with everything that he's doing. It's really quite fun to follow Brandon.
He has a Twitter, too, and I'm pretty sure he has the two accounts linked, so when he updates one, the other does. So you don't have to sign up for both, but you can.
Yeah, it's very cool. And we do before this modern technology. And anyway, I would
Pigeons.
Also like to, yeah, would also
oh, that reminds
message
me.
Message cow, LOL.
Yeah, and our pigeon roost, our pigeoner, is that the correct title for him? I don't remember. The guy who raises the fourth age pigeons, he's told me that the hatchlings are now ready. They are where they can actually carry messages back to us. And if you get in touch with him, he will send you a pigeon, and you can use it to send us a message.
Well, good luck with that. If you know how to channel, be sure that you have the courtesy to send through the little chime first so that you don't cut anybody in half when you open the gateway. So far, nobody's done that yet. I think I'm pretty glad about that in a way. And I do promise one thing is that we will be having more voicemails on the episodes now, maybe not necessarily a whole podcast devoted to voicemails, but just reading one or two as they come along now that Spencer has been clever enough to figure out how to incorporate them into the podcast as we're doing it so that we don't have to have a patchwork cut-and-paste fest trying to edit things together afterwards. So you will be seeing more voicemails on the podcasts. I was thinking about doing a few departments, so I'm just going to throw this out here. I haven't really consulted with the guys yet. Maybe we want to cut this out. I don't know, but I'm just going to throw this out here. I liked in the past, the previous podcast team had a few departments. We had Ben's crazy theories and so forth and so on, and I wouldn't mind reviving the crazy theories. You guys have any ideas for anything like that? Feel free to let us know. We see a way to incorporate it. We like it. We'll use it. Oh, and I really, really seriously want to thank all of the people who volunteered to edit. The response was overwhelming and very gratifying and life-saving for the podcast because we were just getting bogged down in the fact that we can record every week almost without fail, but we just cannot get the things edited. I don't have the time to edit, neither does Andrew. Spencer's been our mainstay lately, and it's just too much for one person. Hopefully now we're assembling a whole team so that nobody's too overburdened and just burns out, and we'll be able to get these out to you. Our goal is to release one a week, because that's how often we pretty much record. So, on the light willing, we'll get it done.
Yeah. I want you all to know that contrary to popular belief, no one here at the Fourth Age receives the spy reports from Ravens or Rat. Jason is really annoyed. He's tired of having to relay the messages to us. So if you would stop trying to use Rats and Ravens and such to get messages to the Fourth Age, we'd appreciate it.
But you can use the message cow.
Always the cow.
I tell you, I've seen the box marked Rats from Jay. I mean, seriously, it's a zoo.
It's not a pretty sight. I think if they start to nibble on his Magic the Gathering cards, though, there will probably be Balefire. There will be Balefire.
Really? None of you got that?
Do I think anybody got that? Sure.
I wasn't talking about a box of rats.
What were you talking about?
Rats and ravens are generally the eyes and ears for the Dark One.
Yeah, no, I know.
Yeah, we got that. Well, I think that's pretty much going to wrap up this episode. So this is Virginia saying, walk in the light until we meet again.
And until we get together again, may you find water and shade.
And for myself, Andrew Gellos, and everyone here at the Fourth Age, Saravian and Domanshima, Taishite. Something, something, sided. Something, something complete.
Side note, one of our editors hasn't read TGS yet.
Uh-oh. Are you in trouble?
Yeah.
Yeah, we're not only going to spoil.
What I sent him.
Press the right button.